for as I could see. Well, I looked down the road as far as I could see. Well, a man had my woman and the blues old hat for me. Well, I walked and I walked, my feet got soaking wet. I walk and I walk, my feet got soaking wet. Well, I ain't found my baby and I ain't quit walking it.
Favor I'll ask of you, one kind favor I'll ask of you, one kind favor and I'll ask of you, see that my grave is kept clean. Hear that church bell toll? Ever hear that church bell toll? Ever hear that church bell toll? Another poor boy's dead and gone. No wind. Lonely lane ain't got no wind. Coming down with your long lost friend. Long lost friend. Did you ever hear that coffin sound? Did you ever hear that coffin sound? Did you ever hear that coffin sound? Another poor boy is dead and gone. Following me, two white horses following me, two white horses following me. Nothing but trouble in the world I see. One kind favor I'll ask of you, one kind favor I'll ask of you, one kind favor and I'll ask of you, see that my grave is kept clean. Thank you.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
I've been getting more and more emails from you guys, from people in the audience, where folks are increasingly confused about, is Russia making progress? Is Russia going to be taking over Ukraine? Or is Russia losing? Because anecdotally, we have, for example, what we're going to start with today, the story of Russia seizing the first major Ukrainian city, which would suggest, well, yeah, it does seem as though Russia is ultimately going to take Ukraine. But at the same time, there are widespread reports of Russian soldiers breaking down, crying, surrendering in Ukraine, calling mommy, quite literally. I mean, soldiers just calling their moms. And how could both be true? And the way that both can be true is that on the one hand, Russia's military is so dramatically larger and more powerful than that of Ukraine that there's some feeling of almost inevitability as to the ability of Russia to make progress into Ukraine. But at the same time, individually, there are soldiers, groups of soldiers that don't want to be there, that don't want to do what they've been sent to do, and are just bailing. And both can be true because the conflict is becoming so widespread and more than one thing can happen at the same time. So bear that in mind as we talk about this first headline. The BBC reporting Russian troops have taken control of the key city of Kherson. And this is considered the first, quote, major city taken control of by Russia, close to 300,000 people. So not a massive metropolis, but certainly not a small town. BBC reporting Russian forces have seized control of a key port city in southern Ukraine. Kherson is the first major city taken by Russia after heavy fighting, now 1 week into the invasion. Its mayor, Igor Kolikaev, said Russian troops forced their way into the city council building and have now imposed a curfew on residents. So the city appears to truly have been taken in the literal sense of the word. Several cities are under intense shelling. Wednesday was one of the most destructive days of the fighting. An investigation into possible war crimes and crimes against humanity has been launched in the ICC. We talked about that request earlier this week. Russia has for the first time admitted taking heavy military casualties, 498 troops killed, 1,600 injured. Now, this number is not a small detail. For a force as overwhelming as that of Russia's is relative to Ukraine's, the fact that in a week, they're admitting 500 have died. And remember, what they admit and the full scope of it may be two different things. They're admitting to almost 100 dead a day. Now, does Putin care about that? No, probably not. But that is not an insignificant number based on the military analyses that I've seen. Now, one other thing I want to point to here that is important. In a Facebook post, Mr. Kolikov, who's the mayor of Kherson, said Russian forces were in control of the city. He urged Russian soldiers not to shoot at civilians, saying there are no Ukrainian forces in the city. And increasingly, and as I've said to you guys before, we are when things are moving so quickly, it can be difficult to know what's true and what's not true. There are now regularly claims of Russian aggression against just random civilians in multiple instances. And here the mayor is coming out and saying, there are no soldiers here. Anybody you see is a civilian. Please don't shoot anybody. Now, the counter that Russia has already started is, well, there have been numerous calls for a week now for any able-bodied individual to take up arms. And so the fact that they are civilians doesn't mean they are unarmed or that they don't present a threat to Russian troops. That's the counter. but the mayor of Kherson saying, there's no troops here. Please don't shoot civilians. And the belief is that indeed civilians have been killed, that, as we told you earlier this week, a kindergarten was bombed, an orphanage was bombed, etc. That's the latest. There is this, you know, when we imagine the sort of prototypical police state kind of military rule, some of these elements are in place. The conditions set by Russian forces include a curfew from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m., only going out in groups of two, and allowing only cars carrying food, medicine, and supplies to enter the city, driving slowly. So this is quickly taking the ambiance, and that term does not seem strong enough, but the ambiance of a military police state. And tomorrow on the program, you know, for those saying, how long could this go on? Could this be over in 5 days? Could this be months? The answers are both yes, but there are now reports from U.S. and America, U.S. and British intelligence and foreign ministries that this could be a 10 to 20 year conflict. Now, that doesn't mean it would be like this for 20 years, but that it could be one of these protracted conflicts, and we'll talk about that on tomorrow's program. Okay, so we talked about some elements of this seem like Russia is pushing to take Ukraine and that they ultimately will be able to, and it's a matter of when, not if. That's the earlier story we did about Russia seizing its first major Ukrainian city, Kherson. We now have to talk about the numerous stories that have been published and videos that have been published, so we know that this is happening, of crying Russian soldiers surrendering all over Ukraine. And these are legitimate, believable stories. Business Insider: some Russian troops are surrendering to Ukrainian forces without a fight as morale drops, U.S. defense official says. Some Russian troops have been surrendering to Ukrainian forces with no fight. The senior official said the Russian military appears to be risk averse. The official said among Russia's military are young draftees who have never faced combat. You've seen it on the ground where units are surrendering sometimes without a fight. And they've got a lot of these soldiers are conscripts, never been in combat before, some of whom we believe weren't even told they were going to be in combat. So we're just seeing evidence of a bit of risk aversion. Russia's troops also struggling with fuel and sustainment issues. And we talked about that on yesterday's bonus show. This convoy of tanks, which we will talk about again on today's bonus show, reportedly moving as slowly as 3 miles per day, partially because the troops have a lack of food and the tanks have a lack of gas. And if that's the case, obviously we would welcome that. That being said, this official says they will regroup, they will adjust, they will change their tactics. Another report: captured Russian soldier breaks down in tears after being humiliated by Ukrainians. A Russian soldier was filmed crying while being humiliated by Ukrainians as the war following Russia's invasion rages on. During the video, the soldier is seen sitting on some steps, sobbing with his face in his palms. At the same time, a few people standing in front of him are heard swearing in Ukrainian. Pictures and videos showing Russian soldiers captured by Ukraine have been posted all over the place. So how could both of these things be true? How could, on the one hand, Russia's forces be overwhelming and taking cities and by some indications, almost inevitably, ultimately going to take over Ukraine? And yet there are soldiers crying. Well, it's because at the individual level, many of these soldiers are completely demoralized. And as the article says, some weren't told that they would be facing combat. Many have never faced combat. And all of a sudden they are there and they are just bailing. At the same time, the forces are so large, Russian military forces, that even if you've got hundreds of demoralized troops saying, what the hell am I doing here? I want to go home. Let me call my mom. There are enough to still continue overwhelming Ukrainian cities. There's one video here of, there's examples of everything. This is a surrendered Russian soldier being treated well, being given food, being given drinks, and allowed to quite literally call mommy. And I'm not saying that in a pejorative way. I mean, we're talking about almost kids here who are just being sent in to fight a battle many of them don't want to fight and that very few people actually understand. Take a look at this.
They don't know where they're going. They're just blocking. Вставайте, женщина, вставайте, весь на ноги поднимайте.
Okay, and I understand that the audio alone, unless you speak Ukrainian and or Russian, is not super relevant, but there is an individual here believed to be a Russian soldier who is drinking what appears to be tea, being handed food, and Skyping with his mom, and being helped to do so by Ukrainians. And of course, this doesn't mean that there aren't examples of anything you can imagine taking place, but a very interesting moment. And the question increasingly is, like, who really wants to be doing this? Are even the Russian forces who are not surrendering thrilled about this mission? And a lot of these videos kind of tell us a lot about not only what is going on. I mean, they say a lot about the Ukrainian people, and many, when Russian soldiers say, hey, you know what, I give up, I don't want to be here, I don't want to do this, they are treated well. But just about the dynamics on the ground. And it's heartbreaking, quite frankly, at the same time that such horrible things are being done at the top level by Putin and others. A lot of these soldiers, and this is not different than in the United States. I mean, you could say that the predatory nature of military recruiting in the U.S. also makes victims out of a lot of these young people, those who got sucked into the war in Iraq. And I mean, listen, it's not news to most people in our audience. There's a lot of victimhood here, real victimhood, and it is disturbing to see. And when these things take place like this, where everybody says, hey, you know what, none of us want this, let's all sort of relate to each other as humans. Nice moments, although unfortunately they don't change the Russian policy, and Putin seems determined to keep going, at least for the time being. We have so much more on today's show. You can find me on Twitter at dpacman and let me know how long you think this is going to continue. We have so much more to discuss right after this short break. The David Pakman Show is a viewer community supported program. We really depend on your support to do what we do. And whether you listen to the podcast or watch a YouTube clip or a live stream here or there, I would love for you to sign up at joinpakman.com. We do offer some great viewer perks, listener perks when people become members, including a daily extra show. We do an additional show just for our members, as well as providing commercial-free audio and video streams to you, priority access when we do viewer town halls, another one of which we should really schedule the next one soon. We should do that for March for sure. And so many other great things. You can sign up at joinpakman.com. If you, I believe the normal membership rates are very reasonable, but if you'd like a discount, you can use the code WOW22 to save. Major breaking news last night, and that is that the January 6th committee investigating the Trump riots has now laid out in clear terms the possible criminal charges against Donald Trump. Now, remember, they can't bring criminal charges. These are members of the House. They have investigative powers. It is up to the Justice Department, currently guided by Attorney General Merrick Garland, to decide. Are we bringing criminal charges or not? But there was this open question for a very long time. Would the investigation point to criminal charges against Donald Trump? And the answer now is yes. And of course, the million-dollar question is there a prosecutor willing to bring charges against a former president? So we'll start with a New York Times article. January 6th committee lays out potential criminal charges against Trump. In a court filing, the panel said, there was enough evidence to suggest Trump might have engaged in a criminal conspiracy as he fought to remain in office. These are such strange times where outrageous things are normalized. Things that would have been unthinkable at times past. Five of them happen in a week and we just kind of don't react. This is not normal. This is a really big deal. Not only is there a committee investigating riots incited by a former president desperate to keep his grip on power on January 6, 2021. But they believe that he may have engaged in criminal conspiracy. The House committee investigating the riots said there is enough evidence to conclude former President Donald Trump and some of his allies might have conspired to commit fraud and obstruction by misleading Americans about the outcome of the election and attempting to overturn the result. This is a big, big deal. In a court filing in a civil case in California, the committee's lawyers, for the first time, laid out their theory of a potential criminal case against Donald Trump. They said they had accumulated evidence demonstrating that Trump, the conservative lawyer John Eastman, and other allies could potentially be charged with criminal violations, including obstructing an official proceeding of Congress and conspiracy to defraud the American people. The filing also said the men might have broken a common law statute against fraud through Trump's repeated lies that the election had been stolen. The filing disclosed only limited new evidence. The committee asked the judge in the civil case to review the material behind closed doors. This is insane. In asserting the potential for criminality, the committee largely relied on the extensive and detailed accounts already made public of the actions Trump and his allies took to keep him in office after defeat. CBS reporting, House January 6 committee says it has evidence Trump and allies engaged in, quote, criminal conspiracy. The House Select Committee investigating the riots said in a court filing, it has evidence Trump and allies engaged in a criminal conspiracy by trying to block Congress from certifying the election. This is the first time the committee has laid out a potential criminal case against Donald Trump. This is a significant moment in the investigation because it includes rare disclosure of findings, excerpts from depositions and interviews with witnesses, including Mike Pence's top advisor, former Justice Department leaders, and those close to Trump. Newsweek. Donald Trump could face criminal charges after explosive John Eastman emails revealed. Remember, John Eastman's this lawyer who laid out what a theoretical framework for trying to flip the results of the election. This is not normal, but, and I know I'm getting now dozens of emails and voicemails from viewers and listeners every day. David, do you still think Trump won't go to prison? Yes. Yes, I do. And people who say, David, when you say that, it makes it less likely he will go to prison. No, I'm a random guy with a microphone. No potential prosecutor cares what I am saying. It doesn't make any difference. We have a situation here where, think of the steps. First, there has to be some prosecutor willing to be the first to charge Donald Trump, a former president. That already takes a lot. And it doesn't seem Merrick Garland is going to be that guy. We've talked about Southern District of New York. We've talked about Manhattan District Attorney. We've talked about Georgia. Are any of these prosecutors willing to be the first? I don't deny that if one prosecutor filed charges, more would fall. I believe there would. I believe that there's many prosecutors willing to be the second prosecutor or the third prosecutor to file charges against Trump. I'm not seeing any evidence anyone is willing to be the first. If you did see that, in almost 99% of these types of cases, you don't get a trial. You get some kind of a plea. You get charges being dropped because things get complicated, etc. If you get a trial, you don't necessarily get a guilty verdict. If you get a guilty verdict, you almost certainly don't get prison time. So think about the number of steps here. So yes, if you want my opinion, and that's all it is, I don't think Trump does a day in prison. Will we see charges at some point? Maybe. That's far more likely than prison time, but that is still my belief at this point in time. If you disagree with me, let me know. I have an unbelievable clip for you today. Donald Trump was interviewed yesterday by Fox News propagandist Maria Bartiromo, who has gone from being a pretty good and respectable finance and economic journalist 15 years ago, 20 years ago, to being a Trump brown noser on Fox News, the ultimate Trump brown noser, allowing unhinged conspiracy theories to be spread on her programs over the last year. Maria Bartiromo interviewed Donald Trump, and it might not shock you to hear that Donald Trump now says the Ukrainians are only even putting up a fight thanks to the weapons I gave them. Now, you might hear that and say, wait, David, sir, aren't those the weapons he delayed giving to Ukraine because he wanted dirt on Biden? And the answer is yes, it is exactly those weapons. But Donald Trump, in the period of 8 days, has gone from Putin is savvy, genius, and smart for what he's doing with Ukraine, taking great property in Ukraine, to actually, Putin's not good. This wouldn't have happened under, well, he didn't say Putin's not good, but he said this wouldn't have happened under my watch, to now saying Ukraine should be thanking me that they're even putting up a fight because they're using the weapons I gave them. Listen to this delusional 180. By the way, the translation here, the 5-second version of this clip is me, 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 me. That's the summary.
Now, Russia has gotten in deeper than they ever thought possible. So they would, frankly, I think they probably would be right now in a good position to do something with. I think they're in much deeper than they thought, to a certain extent, because of the weapons that I gave and that the Ukrainians used so well. I mean, they used so well. Amazing.
Isn't
so I think
that
Russia is something could be done with them right now because they're not
like
looking
what?
So
What's
good. They're
the
looking,
solution?
But they are looking. Well, they have to. You have to work out a deal. They have to stop killing these people. They're killing all these people. And they have to stop it. And they have to stop it now. But they don't respect the United States. And the United States is like, I don't know, they're not doing anything about it.
So these are really inspirational foreign policy assessments from Donald Trump. So, yes, Trump is saying, thanks to the weapons I initially withheld while I attempted to extort Zelensky. Okay, that's the translation here. Thanks to those weapons I originally withheld for the extortion I attempted, but was ultimately sort of pressured into giving Ukraine because things blew up and Alexander Vindman testified and all that stuff. Thanks to those weapons, Ukraine now is to some degree resisting Russian aggression. It is out of this world, guys, completely out of this world. He withheld military aid because he wanted Zelensky to get him dirt on Joe Biden, open an investigation, and then the whistle was blown. It wasn't a perfect phone call. He released the aid. He got impeached on and on and on. And had it not blown up in his face, I mean, really understand the scope of that. When we go back and we remember, okay, he withheld the aid, but then he gave it to them. But why did he give it to them? He gave it to them because things exploded and people found out about what he was doing. Had Vindman not blown the whistle, had everything that happened not happened, Ukraine would not likely have gotten those weapons or certainly not in any kind of reasonable amount of time. And so thanks to the people who blew the whistle over what Trump was doing to extort Ukraine, Ukraine got some of those weapons. And of course, it's also extraordinarily self-centered because the truth is Ukraine now has received weapons and military aid from countries all over the world and additionally from the Biden administration. So even taken at its face, what Trump is saying is absurd. But everything somehow is about him. Putin was so scared of him that he didn't do this while Trump was president. The weapons that Ukraine is fighting with are thanks to Trump. Everything is Trump. It's me, me, me. And unfortunately, if you look at interviews with Trumpists, many of them have fallen for this stuff. Okay, one other quick story here. We now have an actual poll. What did people think of Joe Biden's first official State of the Union address on Tuesday? Remember, I gave it a B. And I thought there were some good parts and some not so good parts. Almost 80% of those who watched it believe that Joe Biden was on point and approve of his remarks. This is surprising even to me, quite frankly. Nearly 8 in 10 of State of the Union watchers approve of Joe Biden's remarks. 78% in a new CBS YouGov poll said that they approve of Biden's remarks. 22% disapproved. Those surveyed were also asked to check all of the feelings that applied to them, and many said they came away with positive feelings. 67% said they were optimistic, 50% said they felt proud, only 20% said they were pessimistic, and 13% angry. Now, you have to consider that this is of people who watched, and quite certainly, because it's a Democratic president, more of those who watched may indeed be Democrats. But there's also a CNN poll conducted by SSRS, which said 71% had a positive reaction. Although, again, friendlier audiences, more Democrats than Republicans, tend to be attracted to these speeches. A couple of different notes here. Number one, some of these Insta polls online, you know, there's a lot of right wingers will say, whoa, look at this. Only 48% liked the speech. Understand that those Insta polls are worth the gum on the pre-chewed gum on the bottom of your shoe. They're really worth nothing. Anybody, whether you saw the speech or not, can weigh in. And even people who might have thought the speech was okay will just lie on those. Those are notoriously not accurate. We really should be looking at actual polling. Couple different thoughts. One, there may be a little bit of a rally around the flag going on, the Ukrainian flag. And we know in general, approval for presidents and approval for speeches like these tend to be higher when there is such a conflict. In this case, it's a conflict elsewhere, but it's one that most of the world is united in terms of who should we be supporting here. And that was the strongest part of Biden's speech, the part about Ukraine. So that may certainly be a factor. The other thing is, I always like to be reminded that my interpretation of these things is very different than people who don't follow this stuff as closely. And I think it's a good reminder for all of us, because even people who listen to shows like mine are probably not like the average, in that most people don't listen to political stuff or follow politics as closely as you do, who, if you're watching this clip or listening today, you are not likely the sort of average person. And although I gave it a B and thought it had a lot of weak moments, clearly those who watched it had a much better impression. And I think that that's interesting for us to keep in mind. It's particularly interesting. I mean, listen, I gave it a B and said it had some good parts. People like Ben Shapiro said this is essentially the worst speech ever. It was pathetic. It was out of touch. It was filled with lies and rambling. And Biden was confused. He didn't know what was going on. Very few people who watched it came away with that impression either. A lot of the focus online has been, oh, Biden meant to say Ukrainian and he said Iranian. But the average person who watched it is not even thinking about that. And that's an important reminder for us as well. So a well-received speech. The question now will be, and Monday we'll look at this, does Joe Biden's approval rating recover? Because it's essentially at his presidency low. Will this speech help him recover? We will see. We'll have clips from these segments on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. Today, we're going to be speaking with Kelly Weil, who's a journalist at The Daily Beast, where she covers extremism, disinformation, and the internet. Also author of Off the Edge, Flat Earthers, Conspiracy Culture, and Why People Will Believe Anything. Kelly, really great to have you on today.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to get a little bit to the resurgence of Flat Earth specifically, because I think it's an interesting kind of window into a lot of the stuff that you cover. But if we zoom out a little bit, you know, when I've spoken to both extremists and those who cover extremists, often they say that the folks most likely to fall into these types of beliefs generally are folks with, on the one hand, certain personality characteristics, but on the other hand, with backgrounds that are often about not having something that they feel a sense of belonging towards. And sometimes this relates to parenting, sometimes this relates to communities or bullying in school or these sort of types of things. What's your sense covering this and researching it about what makes folks more likely to, as you say in the title of the book, believe anything?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a few factors. And one thing that I have to flag is that we're all susceptible to conspiratorial thinking to some degree. It's not some weird thing that tinfoil hat people do. It really emerges when we feel like we don't have enough information or the information we have isn't comforting for us. It doesn't reaffirm our priors. But you're right to bring up that sort of sense of isolation, because one of the things that people go looking for when they seek out Flat Earth or another conspiracy theory is a sense of belonging, is a sense of community. And conspiracy theories often work in this weirdly team-based way. It becomes sort of an us versus them mentality, where you're either on the inside of this small community that says it has all the answers and the world is out to get us, or you're on the other side and by definition evil and scheming. So I think those communities are very alluring for people who both want community and want answers. And it repackages them in a way that I think is it's very appealing for certain people.
The comfort thing is interesting, because one of the characteristics, not of Flat Earth specifically, but of some other conspiracy theories, including that random events were actually planned, what seems to underlie it is that it's really stressful to think or to believe that random bad things happen that you couldn't possibly protect yourself from, and that it's sort of a matter of chance whether you personally are affected by something or not. It seems that some people get comfort from believing it was planned, and at least some people knew exactly when and how this was going to happen.
Yeah, and it's weird to think what's comforting for certain people, because if you told me that, you know, there's a whole bunch of evildoers in a dark room scheming all these events. It's actually the opposite of comforting to me. That's a little distressing. But for some people, that's better than the idea of pure chaos.
Right.
Or they often make it very theological. You know, they don't like the idea that there's nobody looking out for them. And, you know, to tie this back to flat earth, one of the best reasonings I've heard for someone getting into flat earth theory is they believe the earth is like, the universe is very small. It's this little flat earth contained under a snow globe, basically. And she said that she didn't like the idea that the universe was so big and so random, and that she was this little point in it. And when she compressed all the unknown knowns into this, again, really small snow globe, that she realized that she was special and she had a place in the universe. And so I think that explains a little bit of it.
You write about how there was actually a flat earth movement in the 1830s. And I think many people might just say, well, you know, we just knew a lot less then. But actually, 1830 was not the start of when we started to realize that that the spherical earth is actually what it is. Can you talk a little bit about kind of what led that movement and what the beliefs were based on?
Totally. So you're right. I mean, we've known for more than 2000 years now that Earth is round. And it's because it's actually pretty easy to prove. Old timey mathematicians in Greece and Egypt were doing this for ages. What happened in the 1830s, 1840s was it was a time of upheaval. It was a time of technological and scientific revolution. And that is a moment when people go looking for alternative answers. And as new ideas of science and evolution were forcing religion to take the back seat in a lot of people's minds, people started looking for reasons to discount science. And Flat Earth emerged from this really wacky character. He was a failed commune leader. He sold fake medical cures for a while. He had this theory that because Earth looks flat, it must be flat. And not only that, but it's that scientists are actively colluding to hide the reality from you. So for people who wanted to opt out of new fields of science, this was the golden ticket.
Right. And when we think about the resurgence of flat earth, like over the last 6 to 10 years, it's interesting that we have so many more technological means available to us now and so many different ways to easily prove that the earth is not flat. And yet it has still resurged, but on a sort of different basis, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, for about 200 years now, we've been watching flat earthers come up with new reasons to discard new scientific evidence. In the during the space race, flat earthers had to contend with, okay, why are there pictures of Earth from outside Earth if we're all underneath this snow globe? And increasingly, I'm seeing people not really try to contend with the evidence at all, but say that any new conflicting evidence is actually proof of a scheme against them. It's fabricated. It's there to deceive them. So one thing is that this theory and many other conspiracy theories are not really about the provability or the believability. They're about people's willingness to believe against all odds. And when you get that kind of motivated reasoning, it becomes really easy to just chuck out evidence that you don't like.
You know, in the past, when I've interviewed experts on conspiracism and conspiratorial thinking, often we kind of start from the point of flat earth being one of the most benign, non-empirically based sort of conspiratorial beliefs, and that it might exist in a sort of isolated, benign space. But many of these folks who study this say, well, rarely do people just have one of these beliefs. And so there's really more than random overlap between like flat earth beliefs, Illuminati, one world government, anti-Semitic beliefs, you know, that all these different things are linked more than you would expect by random chance. And so while flat earth specifically might sort of be benign, it's often the same types of folks that go to the flat earth conferences that are doing some of the other stuff. Do you agree with that assessment? Disagree with it? Partially agree?
I absolutely agree. And I think it's getting worse too. I started following flat earth around 2017. And even at that time, I thought it was a little bit more siloed. I didn't see so much interchange with other conspiracy theories. Whereas now I see a lot more active networking. What would have been Purely Flat Earth Facebook page 2017 is now sharing a lot of COVID disinfo or thinly veiled QAnon. And, you know, it does make sense in a way, because if you believe in something so literally world encompassing as flat Earth, you're not going to believe that every other established reality holds true. Right. You know, flat Earth lets you just knock down all the facts and build your own. And so it's very easy for people to draw on pre-existing conspiracy theories. And you're right to note that a lot are anti-Semitic or hateful in nature.
One of the interesting things about flat Earth is there's this kind of common belief, which I think is borne out by the studies, which is you can't just give facts to folks who believe certain things. And sometimes the more facts you give them, the more they actually resist changing their perspective. And the interesting thing in that context about flat Earth is that they have rebuttals to just about every, you know, purported rebuttals, I think I should say, to just about every empirical claim that you can present to them with data and with facts and with observation. And so it's sort of like the perfect experiment as to what does get folks to revise their beliefs. When it comes to people who were flat earthers but were disabused of those beliefs, what has worked effectively?
What has worked with the ex-flat earthers that I've spoken to is not exactly debate, because I think when people debate, they dig into their own beliefs. They double down. They don't want to be proven wrong. What I've found has helped in the limited cases of deconversions, because I think people need to be willing to deconvert, is they've had compassionate discussions with round earthers, people who aren't here to belittle them or prove them wrong or have one of these awful YouTube live stream debates, but say, okay, why did you come to this belief? And, you know, what emotionally is motivating you to do this? And what can we do that's observable to you? You know, can we go watch the sunset over the horizon? Will that help? And that kind of compassionate exchange, one that, you know, takes into account the humanity of the person that you're trying to talk to and the emotional needs that drive them to conspiracy theories, often, I think, is a lot more fruitful than this this belittling, or I keep using the term team-based, but it's conspiracy theories are very team-based. And if you turn it into an us versus them debate, it follows that that's not going to convert somebody.
What are the motives that flat earthers believe explain why the powers that be, so to speak, would want folks believing that the Earth is actually spherical when it's flat?
That's a really tough one. And it's one that I ask a lot of flat earthers, and I get a range of answers. And quite a lot of people say, I don't really know. Mm. I mean, the upsetting answer is a lot of people will say something pretty anti-Semitic.
Right.
Or they'll use
even,
you know,
though, like, why would the Jews benefit from the Earth really being flat, but people thinking it's spherical? Like, I don't even know.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, none of these theories, because they're, you know, it goes back and is building on centuries of conspiratorial frameworks. None of them actually hold up. There's no reason a religious group would want to disguise the Earth's shape, but, you know, they'll make those callbacks, or they'll use something a bit more veiled, the Illuminati, the New World Order. They'll say that that the powers that be want to downplay the role of religion in the world, or they want to keep people confused. Or the best answer I ever got was this guy. So flat earthers generally don't believe in outer space. And this guy is like, well, what I think is going on is they want us to believe in space, so they want us to believe in aliens, so that when Jesus comes down again, we'll think he's an alien and we'll kill him. So
that's pretty tough to talk someone out of. I mean, that's the crazy thing about it.
Oh, that was really rough, because, I mean, he clearly thought about this for much longer than I was ever going to.
Yeah.
But the long and short of it is people are really willing to believe this theory, and sometimes the specifics or even the motivation come secondary.
Can you talk a little bit about the social media platform algorithms, like on Facebook and YouTube, and specifically like with flat? I think many in my audience generally understand controversy does better algorithmically. So then in general, platforms will share articles that are negative, divisive, etc., with no regard for whether they are accurate or not. But what are we seeing about these algorithms specifically with Flat Earth?
Flat Earth has performed really, really well historically in social media algorithms, especially on YouTube. There was a period from about 2014 to 2019 when Flat Earth videos got this massive artificial boost. And the reason is, I mean, YouTube is a company. They want to make money, and they make money from you staying on the site and watching videos.
Yeah.
And so because Flat Earth was something that I'm guilty of this too. Everybody clicks on at 2 in the morning. Those videos perform very well algorithmically, and people would get recommended to them even if they weren't seeking them out. So YouTube did change its algorithm after tons of criticism by 2019, but the fact still stands for 5 years. This was a really just like open fire hose of Flat Earth info into unsuspecting people's feeds.
Last thing I wanted to talk about, can you talk a little bit about in the culture, in the landscape right now of conspiracy theories and sort of extremist beliefs, what are maybe some less known things that are maybe coming up? I mean, I think QAnon, my audience knows about Flat Earth, election was stolen, vaccines are killing millions, but nobody, you know, some of the obvious ones I think my audience is aware of. But is there anything kind of like up and coming that you're tracking?
Oh, man. The question is always like whether to talk about it if it's up and coming.
Right.
You know, I think to put it a different way, I mean, there are always fringe theories on the up. What I think is different now is their embrace in mainstream Republican politics. Mm. So whereas QAnon was something that was, you know, on its face, completely absurd and deranged, now we're seeing this much more wholesale embrace of things like election conspiracy theories by the Republican Party. And, you know, as much as I will criticize things for like social media for their role in promoting conspiracy theories, this, I think, is uncharted or not recently charted territory.
You mean the degree to which the Republican Party has participated?
Exactly. Mm. Their role in promoting it and their role in normalizing it. And I think that is pretty dangerous. And as much as, you know, we can rail on the YouTubes and the Facebooks for promoting disinfo, this is an integral part of American politics, and it is just diving all the way in on conspiracy theories.
Do you have an opinion as to for how long will they continue with the evidence is just about to come out? I mean, because it's we're at 15 months now, and Rudy Giuliani and Trump, and I mean, they continue to say, We're about to get the stuff from Georgia. We're about to get the stuff from does this have a long life ahead of it, you think?
I think it does, but not because they're going to keep claiming the evidence is coming out. It's like Flat Earth, where the evidence doesn't really matter. It's an emotional appeal, right? So after they see this narrative for so long, it doesn't really matter that they keep getting disproven because people believe it. There's enough of this saturation of the story that people want to believe. And by that point, they'll have already, you know, taken down voting sites in predominantly Black neighborhoods. They'll already have passed legislation that makes it difficult to send in absentee ballots. And that, I think, is like the real tangible risk of this conspiracy theorizing, is it enables things that are very real.
Yeah, at this point, it's almost like they're signaling their membership in a team by repeating that rather than we literally are waiting around for the evidence.
Totally. Yeah, if only they were waiting around, because I mean, they'll be doing that till they die.
For a very long time, yeah. Yes. Kelly Weil is a journalist at The Daily Beast. The book is Off the Edge, Flat Earthers, Conspiracy Culture, and Why People Will Believe Anything. Kelly, really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's do a little bit of follow-up about what is the most disgusting moment during any State of the Union address that I can remember. And at this point, this is an important story because it wasn't just that Lauren Boebert heckled Joe Biden during the State of the Union. And it wasn't just that Lauren Boebert, radical Republican congresswoman, heckled Joe Biden when Biden was talking about his son who died and served in the military during the State of the Union. But it's about the fact that so many Republicans are refusing to condemn it. And it's about the fact that many in right-wing media are celebrating what Lauren Boebert did. And it's absolutely and completely disgusting. So let's start with our first example. This is Republican Congressman James Comer, who was given the opportunity to condemn what Lauren Boebert did. Remember Marjorie Taylor Greene also yelling out and turning her back to Joe Biden. And he doesn't do it. He doesn't do it. And it wouldn't be that difficult to do it. You could do it in a way where you still say, I mean, listen, at this point, you could say, I completely condemn what they did, but I also am worried about XYZ thing that Biden did, right? Like, it's pretty straightforward to put together a statement like that. That's not what he does. Look at this disgusting response.
Congressman, before we let you go, I do want to ask you about what we all saw and heard, frankly, last night from the chamber. Two of your colleagues, Lauren Boebert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, were shouting at the president throughout his speech. At one moment that I think a lot of people heard, she shouted out 13 of them when the president was talking about soldiers in a flag-draped coffins. Do you think that type of behavior is appropriate?
Well, certainly, whether you agree or disagree with the president, I believe during the State of the Union, we should all show respect to the president. But honestly,
this is the same, and we'll get there. This is like those tweets. Putin shouldn't invade Ukraine, but, and then something horrible follows it.
Share their frustration when you look at the crises that we're facing in this country, especially
understood,
the border
crisis. Should they be vocalizing that in the middle of his State of the Union address? Does that not undercut your party and its messaging on those critical issues?
It's certainly not my style. I've heard that type of behavior from Democrats, too, when we had Republican presidents. So.
No, that's not true. That's not true. The two main heckling incidents are Joe Wilson heckling Barack Obama and Boebert and Green heckling Joe Biden. Those are the incidents.
I just think that the best
Democrats yelled at a business model. Democrats yelled at a Republican president in the chamber. When did that happen?
When Donald Trump was president. So the thing that, you know.
That's not true.
I think Congress should do is just listen. And then we have an opportunity like I'm doing now to speak to the America and speak to the press about our disagreements and move on.
All right, Congressman James.
So what do you guys think? I mean, it's not like Boebert and Green are so prominent in the party leadership that these are people that you can't be adversarial with, or whatever the case may be. Like, is this guy a coward? Is he merely a bad person? Like, what do you guys think is the explanation? Because it's not exactly a profile in courage, and it's even less likely to be condemned when right-wing media is sort of cheerleading the entire thing. And that's what I want to talk about next. So after heckling Joe Biden during Tuesday night's State of the Union address, yelling out when Joe Biden was literally talking about his son that died, Lauren Boebert yelling out. In the aftermath of that, she sort of like got a hero's welcome in a lot of different places. And she was interviewed by Turning Point USA's Charlie Kirk. Now, if you don't know Charlie Kirk and you don't know Turning Point, I envy you. But in all seriousness, it's a very well-funded organization that is pulling in young people to radical right ideology, and they do it very, very effectively. Charlie Kirk interviewed Lauren Boebert, and she defended her actions, saying, listen, I was very caught up in the emotion because I am so worried about the troops that died under Joe Biden. Take a look.
And so I think you wore a Drill Baby Drill shirt as well yesterday, and a lot of the State of the Union is theater. So now I got to ask you, Congresswoman, because we've been receiving a lot of emails, and some of our listeners are divided. I think you could probably see part of why they're divided, because we really went after Nancy Pelosi when she tore the speech. We said, have some respect for the president. What do you have to say for people that say, hey, look, I'm with you, Congresswoman, but maybe you shouldn't interrupt a president at the State of the Union? What's your thought on that?
First of all, I was really caught up in the emotions of it.
So right off the bat, she basically is saying it's like a moral get out of jail free card. It was a moment of passion. It's sort of like you killed someone. Well, it was a crime of passion. I wasn't thinking. She was so caught up in the emotion that that's supposed to be like a blanket exculpation for what she did.
Mentioning Afghanistan, but didn't bother to mention the 13 soldiers. He went on to something totally different. And
totally different. Yeah, his dead son. Totally different.
Really just overwhelmed me. And I couldn't help but speak out. And look, I would love to have a conversation in a better setting with him.
Right. And the way to get such a conversation is by heckling him when he talks about his son who died. And that's, Kyle Rittenhouse the other day he said on some show, we might sue Joe Biden. He might get a letter. It's like, oh, really? Why? Well, he's like, yeah, well, I asked him to meet with me 5 times and he didn't. And it's the same type of idea here. She would like to meet with Joe Biden, but Joe Biden hasn't met with her. So she heckled him while he was talking about dead soldiers and his son who died. And now he's going to meet with you?
I would love to be able to talk to him. And maybe I'll get the chance to do that when Republicans are in the majority in 2023. And we can actually put forward my articles of impeachment for Joe Biden and have a real conversation.
Yeah. You're also not going to have a conversation with Joe Biden if you put forward your silly articles of impeachment, which she and Marjorie Taylor Greene have been talking about now for months.
And as far as the drill baby drill goes, look, Joe Biden, he waged a war on American energy and left us in a very dangerous place. We rely on Russian energy, importing nearly 600,000 barrels of energy per day.
Now, I want to talk about this a little bit. A very popular talking point has become, we were energy independent under Joe Biden, and now we are not. The data is widely available. We cited it in our story about energy independence a couple weeks ago. For the last several years, the U.S. production of oil has matched U.S. consumption of oil. Now, you have to understand that under Biden and under Trump, even though that's the case, there is still trading going on, and we send some oil abroad and also bring some oil in. But in terms of the numbers, for several years now, we've produced as much oil as we've consumed. So the idea that Joe Biden has done any drastic thing where now we are not at that same equivalent level of production and use is just a lie. And she keeps repeating it. No one challenges it. It's not true.
When we should be energy independent and certainly energy dominant, we should be able to export energy to our allies, which is literally exporting freedom. And so I wore drill baby drill on my Shaw to remind the Democrats of exactly what we should be doing.
Yeah, no one cares about that.
And how we should stop funding Russia's war.
Yeah, and that's a lot of the State of the Union is kind of like making alternative points. And I think people understand that. And I'll be honest, like if I was in the audience, I don't know if I would have been able to contain myself. So I think that's a fair answer. If I had to listen to Joe Biden go on and...
Yep. Charlie Kirk would have done the same thing. So there's this soft defense of the completely indefensible, and they're not going to stop. They're going to continue doing it. And unless these folks are just removed or forced to behave differently, they will continue escalating, and it's not going to change, and that shouldn't surprise anybody. Hey, why do people call me to have me defend communism? I'm not a communist. Why would you call me to have me defend that? Here's a voicemail. Our voicemail number is 2192-DAVID-P. And I just don't get, why does anyone care to have me defend communism? I'm not a communist. It's just this guy calls in all the time, asking me to defend things that just have nothing to do with me.
Hey, David, it's Juan again.
Yeah.
A very concise question.
Please.
You like these. If communism is so great, according to people that support communism.
Well, talk to them. I'm not one of those people.
Then why do they prohibit their people from leaving the country that communism reigns in? If it's true that it's very good, they wouldn't need to restrict people from leaving. They would just leave it open. And naturally, the people would just stay there because it's a great system.
Sure.
So if it's a great system, why are they prohibited from leaving? You know what? I screwed up because I wasn't very concise. But you get where I'm going, right? I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. Ask a communist, Juan. Don't ask me. I don't defend communism on this show. This is a great opportunity for me to mention. Later this month, I am going to be in Florida, and I am going to appear on the Patrick Bet David podcast. He's got a huge YouTube channel, 3-4 million subscribers. He's got a podcast. It's a long-form podcast. Patrick Bet David is not on the left, and he asked for a progressive to come on and explain and defend progressivism. And I said, I'll do it. And he said, let's do it. We're going to have you on. Now, one of the things I'm not going to do on that show is defend stuff that I don't believe in. So, one of the difficult things about these types of interviews is it's very plausible that I'll go down there and he'll go, How can you defend, like, just this is just an example. How can you defend the Women's March not allowing Jewish women on their leadership because Jewish women aren't intersectional enough? I'd go, no. I don't, you got to ask someone who supports that. I don't support that. This is like one silly example. But the point is, I'm not going to defend positions that are not mine. I will tell him, you got to ask someone who believes that. And I will say, if it's something that's some kind of fringe thing, not very many people on the left actually believe that. And it's sort of like saying, well, do we need Mitt Romney, or would we have asked the late John McCain to defend some, Richard Spencer or some white nationalist or something? No, it doesn't make any sense. So have me defend things I believe in. I'm not a communist. I'm not here to do apologia for communism. All right, my friend, thank you very much. On the bonus show today, the Russian convoy appears stalled because the tanks don't have much gas and a lot of crazy things are happening. We're going to talk about that. On the bonus show today, the governor of Iowa has signed a flat tax into law. Many states actually have a flat tax, so it's not as unusual as you might think, but we'll talk about flat taxes more generally. And yes, oil prices are surging as there are reports, which we will talk about tomorrow, that the Russia-Ukraine war could last 10 to 20 years, but hopefully it won't. And if it did, it wouldn't be like the current situation, but we'll talk about all of that on today's bonus show. Producer Pat will join me. Don't miss the bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all RDJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
RCT in sound from way out.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats.
my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are warning everybody. Not a single state apart from Russia has ever shelled nuclear reactors. It is the first time in our history, in the history of humankind, that the terrorist state turned to nuclear terrorism.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Russia of nuclear terror after Russian forces shelled the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, sparking a fire that took hours to put out. Russian forces have now seized control of the plant. We'll go to Ukraine for the latest, plus speak to a leading Russian environmentalist about the attack, as well as Russia's escalating crackdown on civil society.
It's very important to stop the war now, and it's very important that Ukraine stays free.
Plus, we speak to a Ukrainian-American journalist who says the Ukraine of his childhood is being erased. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's military says it's taken over the Zaporizhzhia power plant in Ukraine after its forces opened fire on the nuclear facility overnight with rockets, artillery, and gunfire. The assault sparked a fire that burned for hours, though it reportedly did not spread to any of the nuclear plant's six reactors, and there's no sign of an increase in radiation levels at the site. The nuclear plant's operator says managers are now working at gunpoint. Zaporizhzhia is the largest nuclear power station in Europe and the 10th largest in the world. Nuclear experts have been warning for weeks of the risk of a catastrophic meltdown. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. News of the assault drew international alarm. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. U.S. Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts tweeted, "This would be an international war crime by Putin that could result in incredible devastation." Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of nuclear terror.
Europeans, please wake up. Tell your politicians. Russian troops are shooting at the nuclear power plant in Ukraine. Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, city of Enerhodar. There are six nuclear reactors there. Six. In Chernobyl, it was only one reactor, which exploded.
The nuclear crisis came as Russia laid siege to major cities and intensified artillery and missile attacks on heavily populated urban areas in Ukraine. The southern city of Mariupol has been encircled by Russian forces and subjected to intense strikes. Elsewhere, large explosions shook central Kyiv Friday, while Russian forces in the occupied city of Kherson encountered a hostile response from city residents. In Moscow, President Vladimir Putin said the assault is going as planned.
Dear comrades, I want to say that the special military operation is proceeding strictly in line with the timetable according to plan. I will never give up my conviction that Russians and Ukrainians are one people.
French President Emmanuel Macron spoke with Putin Thursday, saying after the call he feared the worst is yet to come and that Russia wants to seize all of Ukraine. The Committee to Protect Journalists has identified a camera operator who died Tuesday when Russian forces blew up a television tower in Kyiv. 49-year-old Yevgeny Sakun was among five people killed in the attack. He worked for the Ukrainian television station Live, which had covered the Russian invasion. In Moscow, Russian authorities on Thursday ordered two TV and radio broadcasters off the air over their coverage of the invasion of Ukraine. Echo of Moscow was one of Russia's oldest radio stations. Meanwhile, workers at the independent station TV Rain held an on-air protest to conclude its final broadcast Thursday. A news anchor's last words were, "No to war," before staffers walked off the set. They then fled their workplace after